50 years ago, I got introduced to fixing saws and met some really interesting people from years ago. They weren't all so dumb 100 years. I like reading antique books, by the way, because there's a lot of knowledge from 100 years ago. Some of those guys didn't have near the technology we got today, and we're pretty darn smart.
Right.
And the principles of the saw are still the same today. I mean, it's chemical, physical, and biological. That hasn't changed. Yeah. It's just how we deal with it, how we understand it, and then we got better tools than we have. We should be able to move forward much faster.
Welcome to the 336th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. On a summer day 30 years ago, I spent some time touring Duane Hager's farm, just a few miles from the Mississippi River in southeastern Minnesota. Duane was one of the first farmers I ever met who was truly obsessed with soil health. As he spaded up samples of earth and explained to me how he was using rotational grazing and diverse rotations to build soil biology, I asked Duane what had launched his fascination with the world beneath our feet. His answer? Gary Zimmer. Duane had taken a soils class Zimmer was teaching at a community college in nearby Winona, Minnesota, and it changed completely his approach to farming. Duane's not the only farmer I've run into over the years who's been deeply influenced by Gary Zimmer's approach to soil management. These days, Gary is recognized as the father of quote-unquote biological farming, a system that takes its cues from nature when it comes to building resilient, living soil. He's the founder of Midwestern BioAg, which offers consulting and other services to farmers who are seeking to tap into soil's homegrown biology. Gary is a very energetic 80-year-old and has been, as he puts it, fixing soils for over 5 decades. He's an internationally known author, speaker, and consultant, and owns Otter Creek Organic Farm, a 1,000-acre certified organic cropping operation in southwestern Wisconsin, where he practices what he preaches. Gary recently spoke at a workshop on soil health economics that the Land Stewardship Project held in Ridgeway in northeastern Iowa. During his high-octane talk, Gary made the point repeatedly that one cannot have a sustainable farm until the soil is regenerated. During the workshop, he presented examples of farm ground he's regenerated utilizing cover crops, composting, and the addition of key minerals. Gary emphasized that when building soil health profitably, one must take the long view, which may mean having a field that's not necessarily churning out a profitable crop every year, but rather is building the kind of biology that can pay dividends in the future. Gary isn't afraid to go against the grain when it comes to managing soil. For example, he believes that some farmers get too fixated on never, ever tilling their fields. He feels conducting tillage with a purpose can play a key role in developing biologically active soil. After his presentation, Gary talked to me about why, before it can be sustainable, a farm must be regenerated by feeding the soil like one would feed livestock. We also discussed how exciting it is to see how far the soil health and biological farming movement has come in the past 50 years. Gary started our conversation describing the difference between soil health and soil fertility.
Soil health is, with NRC, that definition is the capacity to function.
Yeah.
And then I wrote the word without intervention, because if I got to use insecticides, fungicides, pesticides, and biotechnology, it couldn't be very healthy. Just like me being my age and taking all kinds of drugs, you couldn't call me healthy. So soil health is really this capacity to function, which means biology, soil structure, a healthy place to put a crop, a balance of minerals, and all those other things. And so you can see it, you can smell it, so it'll look like a chocolate cake. Water infiltration and something always green on the land are two really major things for soil health. So then soil fertility isn't about how much N, P, and K are on my soil test or even what's on my soil test, but soil fertility is the exchange of nutrients. And in nature, they always come through plants. There's no stuff falling out of the sky or maybe some nitrogen's pulled out by organisms, but the minerals are in a plant. That plant dies, gets digested, and gives us its minerals to the next crop. So we've taken soil fertility. I want all my minerals to be in a carbon biological cycle. So we make compost. We're not afraid to put humates, or we get stuff from anaerobic digesters. We always want a mineral added to a fertilizer. Now, on our own farm, we don't buy any inputs anymore, just sulfur and boron. Those are two things that you can't grow, and there's not enough of them. We cleaned up the atmosphere, cleaning us, so we're low on sulfur all of a sudden. And so those are the only two inputs on our farm. All the rest of the stuff I can exchange and grow, because those two do leach and get away from us.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned, I know your background is in dairy nutrition. One of the things you mentioned is you treat your soil, you feed your soil like you'd be feeding a cow to get, you know, 100 pounds of milk or whatever.
Yes, and that's because dairy nutrition people is quite understandable. I think everybody thought we had to grow these cover crops and get them knee-high and above, but then they rob nutrients and they're slow in digestibility. So if you're growing cover crops, I want to throw the word digestibility. How fast does it break down? I can take a 6-inch tall ryegrass in the spring in front of corn and have a surge of nitrogen. It's highly digestible. And it's high in protein and low in complex carbons at that stage. And so we then evaluate the digestibility of our cover crop based on what we want to do. In front of soybeans, I might let my rye get bigger. I don't need soluble nutrients for soybeans. I'd rather have nodules and I'd rather have the soil biology take over. But on corn, that's a chemistry crop. And I need soluble nutrients. So our cover crops are going to be in that green succulent stage. And that's the stuff we'd feed a cow to get 100 pounds of milk.
Yeah, and speaking of livestock, you said you don't necessarily need the livestock on top of the ground because you have so much below the ground.
That's right. Everybody thinks we've got to have livestock. And first of all, we farm in a 45-mile circle. There's no fences, and we're not going to have cattle running all over the county. And so we've got all kinds of life below the ground. And if everybody thinks that you need livestock to regenerate land, I said you haven't traveled far enough or looked deep enough. I get to a lot of farms all over this planet. There's some beautiful soils on a lot of farms that don't have any livestock except the soil livestock. We all have plenty of those. Take care of those and feed those well. Give them a balanced diet. Do everything you can to take care of the soil life. And I don't need above ground livestock. Not that they're awful and you might be able to get a little extra income from grazing your cover crop, but they also cause compaction. They also cause other issues. I don't need them to make a living.
Yeah. I'm a little bit of a nerd when it comes to words and how words evolve in this kind of movement that we're part of. For years, we called it sustainable agriculture. And one of the things you kind of led your talk off with is it's really not sustainable if you haven't regenerated that farm, that you really have to regenerate the farm first to make it sustainable. I think that's a really, really good point.
And that's kind of what, when I was around when the sustainable ag movement started, and because the interest rates were high in the 80s and guys were losing their farm, they didn't have any money. But that sustainable movement didn't really sustain itself because they needed to do some fixing. They needed to have some intervention, and they didn't, just doing nothing wasn't going to get them there. And that's why I say, like now our farm, we can say, well, we spent a lot of effort fixing soils, regenerating. We just transitioned another 100 acres, and we spent $1,000 an acre on cover crops and compost and minerals, and now it'll be organic this next year. That doesn't mean it's completely fixed. But see, eventually, once that gets down, we get the biology working, get that recycling, and then our input costs really drop. But I have to do that first. I couldn't just start out doing nothing.
Right.
I would get nothing.
Well, you had a really good example of a farm. I think it looked pretty tough, a farm that you'd come in, and the compaction was incredible. You showed some photos of that, trying to dig it up and how it was like hitting concrete. But within 2 years, you were able to make that. Can you describe that? What that process was like? What was it you did to transition that farm to have that really good soil health?
So we always like starting out with a soil sample. We soil sampled it extensively in the beginning, then we do back every 3 to 5 years. So once I figured out that the pHs were really low, we knew we needed to lime it, and it was corn on corn for 8 years in a row with a heavy disc and irrigation. I called it hydroponically farmed, chemicals, water, and soil to stick plants in, but the soil wasn't dependent upon doing anything. And so then the first thing we did is we planted oats in the spring, and then the first year. So then we put on compost, we ran a deep ripper in the ground, and then after the oats, we put in a rye crop, and then we frost-seeded clover in the following spring, and we put on, we got like 4 to 5 tons of compost per acre, and a lot of mineralization, trace minerals went on the land, lime went on the land. Phosphorus levels weren't too bad in the potassium, so we did add some poultry manure in the composting, so we added the food. We're taking care of the biology, and we grew 2 years of cover crops. And so now next year it'll be organic, and the soils, I showed pictures of it when we started, and 2 years later, it doesn't look like the same farm anymore.
Well, and that's something that struck me, is you really made the point that you do have to look at this as a long-term investment, and there are years, you have to kind of look at the general trends and not year to year so much, and that you are going to have years where maybe you're not going to make a big profit or whatever, but that's an investment in that overall profitability.
Yeah, and I think that's real. We want to get to a point where I call now, if we can use that word sustainable, that we can keep growing a really good crop without a lot of inputs, and we can take the ups and downs, but we're not afraid to invest in it. If everybody understood it the way I think we do on our farm or what it takes to, let's get it fixed and get it healthy and get it mineralized and get the soil loose and crumbly like a chocolate cake. And then you've got resilience, and then you've got, you can take more of that other stuff. And we certainly understand that. And we did get a 7-year rental on it because 2 years of fixing it, $1,000 an acre in investments. And now we got 5 years of farming it organically.
Is there some things that you've always been innovative. That's what you're known for. And you're willing to try new things, and I'm sure there's been some, they don't always work out. But are there some things that you would like to try that you've heard about, or you'd like to look into the future that you kind of experiment with?
We're still trying to, I guess we spend quite a bit of time fooling around with tillage tools to say, how can we get less trips and more shallow tillage and get the job done? We got a couple of those high-speed discs we do, and we're always trying to get more efficient by putting seeders on our tillage tools, and we're real believers in that shallow incorporating residues and running a ripper. And so I think the other thing is, if I want in the future, I think I'd like to say, I need to bring up my phosphorus, let's say, and what crop would I plant to do that? Probably oats and buckwheat.
Yeah.
See, oats is kind of one of those, rye is, we do rye everywhere, but oats is another one of those wonderful crops, and then buckwheat to help fix soils. And so I think finding different cover crops, that's why I said to researchers, I tell everybody, we got our basis figured out. We understand the minerals, we understand the biology, we understand the tillage part, but there is a lot of research that needs to be done, is what kind of cover crop, when, how do I manage it? And that's why that group I'm with, Rye Revival, is to, the biggest thing is people plant rye and then they don't understand how to manage it, and they fail and they blame the rye when it's really how they managed it.
Well, speaking of tillage, you talked a little bit about, no-till is great, it's got its role, but people get a little bit, treat it a little bit like a religion and kind of look, get too fixated on it. But I can't think of the term you use, but you said there is a role for tillage in some of these systems.
Yeah, and I call it tillage with a purpose. Yeah. What are we doing it for? You know, there should be a reason why you're doing tillage. And that's why, like I said, there's a couple of really big famous no-till farmers out here, big companies out here did tillage last year on a no-till, 25-year no-till farming system, had a 25 bushel yield increase on corn. Mm-hmm. And they were so hung up on the fact that they weren't going to no-till, they forgot to do the job. There's wet years or compaction with their equipment, and lack of roots being developed. They're only growing corn and beans. They don't have a diversity of crops. There might be intervention times. And just like the guy today said, he didn't do any tilling, but he knifed in manure. And so knifing in manure is like knifing in anhydrous. There was a thing on a YouTube last spring. A guy in Illinois had a 500 horsepower tractor and a 7-shank anhydrous tine, and a YouTube was showing he couldn't pull it. And he's been no-till. He couldn't pull it. Now, I'd say he's got a serious problem. You know, you better hope for ideal rain and moisture. Yeah, you're going to have shallow root, and how do you get nutrient exchange? So I think we got to get the tillage with a purpose, and not saying you need to till all the time or do everything. The focus ought to be healthy soils and high fertility. In other words, a high exchange of minerals. And that would mean cover crops and compost and everything else. And then till if you have to, or don't till.
And you were said maybe in that top couple inches, it's not going to hurt it that much, maybe.
Because everybody gets so hung up on the fact that, you're going to destroy the mycorrhizae. And I said, all the research is done comparing plowing or chisel plowing to no-till. And our shallow incorporating, the mycorrhizae completely encompass the whole root system. What if I double my root system and get it really deep because I got healthy soils? And so I'm doing a little bit of damage to the top, and I'm also breaking the crust, and I'm feeding the soil. If everything laying on top of the ground is going to oxidize up, I'd rather shallow incorporate a bulk of it and still leave a blanket. The real purpose to no-till is the blanket on top of the ground. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm a strip-till guy, because it's like putting a flower pot under every plant. I want to be able to grow that big, beautiful root system in there.
Yeah. What would be one or two things that you would suggest somebody who is just getting their feet wet on something like this? Maybe they're a conventional farmer, maybe they're just getting into farming, or maybe they're making some big switches on what they do. What would be one or two things that could just really help kind of make that entry into this and maybe get some early success without a big putting an outlay of risk?
Yes. So I think I always write down in my rules or something, knowledge is first. And that's why coming to sessions like here today and getting out and visiting farms that are kind of doing a similar kind of farming system what you have, that have taken another step in another direction. You don't have to make every mistake yourself.
Yeah.
I tell people. And I always say, you know, get a good soil test. You got to do some testing. Find some limiting factors. I sampled by a couple of different methods, and we sampled pretty heavy in the beginning. But then every 3 to 5 years to evaluate, once we know where we're heading, we can go with that. You can start on smaller acres. But I also say that as far as fertility, probably calcium, sulfur, and boron ought to be. Gypsum with some boron in it is a major limiting factor on a lot of farms from Sciop, because they've been doing P's and K's all that kind of stuff. So calcium, sulfur, and boron, and getting yourself smart enough, and then say, what kind of a cover crop? If I'm corn bean guy, and that's why putting in rye after soybeans in the fall, and then learn how to manage it and start small. There's some really guys successful. It might take I gave an example, that guy from Winona, Minnesota, that he's got everything's rye after corn and soybeans, but then in this, he plants root early in the spring. If you've got a cover crop, you can get out there early without damaging your soils because you've got roots in the ground, you got something to drive on, and then he plants a shorter day corn so he can get harvested early and give his rye a chance to grow the next year. All those little things, see, people get hung up that we got to grow 110-day corn. Genetics has changed. Shorter day corn is yielding really high. Our yield potential on corn is 400 or 500 bushel per acre, yeah, and most guys are lucky to get two. Yeah. So I said, obviously, the genetic potential is way ahead of what they're getting, so I don't need to plant 110-day corn.
Yeah.
All those little thoughts you got to get in through.
Yeah. So get that soil test first, and then kind of, like you said, your limit, what your limiting factors are.
Start with calcium, sulfur, and boron, and put in some cover crop, and I think you'll see some things change and figure out how to fit that cover crop. Whether you, I see you, organically, we have a hard time interseeding our corn because the time we get done cultivating, it's June. It's pretty hard to plant clover in June. Mm-hmm. But the conventional guy that plants in first days of May or April, by the middle of May, when his corn's up 6 inches, he can put a cover crop in. He's got to watch his chemicals. And he, and now that can still grow during that season because he's planting it in May, and we can't. So interseeding in corn works better for conventional farms than it does organic.
Yeah.
How long have you been kind of involved? I know you've been involved with agriculture your whole life, but how long have you been kind of doing this kind of regenerative type systems?
Yeah, so I called it biological farming because I wanted the farmers to focus on biology. I started my company in, I guess it's 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. I got introduced to soils and dairy nutritionists. That's how we decided to teach cows in soils the same. Yeah. And I was teaching at Winona Area Technical College, and I had to teach classes in soils. And I'm self-taught in soils, and I became a Brookside consultant and got really into soils. Everybody thinks I'm a soils guy, but I didn't learn anything at the university on soils. I learned about chemistry and biology and dairy cows. 50 years ago, I got introduced to fixing soils and met some really interesting people from years ago. They weren't all so dumb 100 years. I like reading antique books, by the way, because there's a lot of knowledge from 100 years ago. Some of those guys didn't have near the technology we got today, and were pretty darn smart.
Right.
They couldn't rely on those crutches of the chemicals.
And the principles of the soil are still the same today. I mean, it's chemical, physical, and biological. That hasn't changed. Yeah. It's just how we deal with it, how we understand it, and then we got better tools than we have. We should be able to move forward much faster.
Yeah.
So you're 80. You've been 50 years ago when you got into this. We're at a workshop here in March, and we've got over 75 people here in a small little Iowa town. I mean, did you ever think that maybe the kind of soil health, regenerative, biological farming movement would get to this place? I mean, this is kind of exciting, isn't it?
It is kind of exciting. I never thought it, because it seemed like I was fighting. See, I think I still feel like I fight every soil concept, every soil chemistry lab, because they're still the cheapest source of NPK and lime to a certain pH. That's the same information they gave out 75 years ago, and they have control of all the research and all the university thinking. So I thought that was a fight. But now, of course, soil conservation people and NRCS, there's all kinds of water conservation people are coming from a different angle, and that's nice to see. I never dreamt it would get to this level.
For more on building soil health profitably, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 336 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendahl, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.